people.
The Desi Ranking Show on BCFM.
Tune in each and every Sunday between the hours of 10 and 12. In the meantime.
Welcome back to BCFM's politics show, Friday Drive Time, with Old Labour Oxford economist Martin Summers and me, Tony Gosling. Well, we're hoping to have a chat with someone about Jill Dando, but we haven't managed to get through to them, I'm afraid. We will hear tonight, hopefully, from some of several witnesses or people who gave evidence to the police about her murder who were simply ignored. Also, grandma to Prince George. Diana's been almost forgotten this week, but not on this show. Also, banned broadcasts from around the world. This week we go and have a listen to what's going on in North Korea. Actually, thankfully, translated into English. Also, the annual Green Gathering Summer Festival starts next week in Chepstow. We get a sneak preview with a chap from the Green Party, Shane Collins, who's also their spokesperson on drugs. But we start this week, as usual, with Martin Summers and his weekly tour of the world's hotspots. Now, Martin, I mean, you're quite free. Feel free to talk about other places if you want. But I've got two particularly I'd like to mention. One is Tunisia, because we've had another assassination in Tunisia. Tunisia I like focusing on because it was the birthplace of this so-called Arab Spring. And that we've already had political parties being banned in Tunisia, very popular parties, one of which was run by a guy who had a TV station based in London, who millions of Tunisians were watching, and when it came to stand for elections he was told he couldn't. Now we've got assassinations going on. So how democratic is the Arab Spring turning out to be in Tunisia?
Well, I mean, Tunisia is in better shape than Syria, but that's not saying much, let's face it. I mean, it's always bad when somebody's assassinated for their political views, whatever those views are, because it creates the precedent that others will be similarly assassinated. And, of course, what's actually happening in Tunisia is because of the military takeover in Egypt, there is hope by those who are opposed to the Islamists that they could perhaps produce something similar in Tunisia. And that, of course, is potentially a recipe for civil war.
Looking at Egypt then, what's your thoughts about the Muslim Brotherhood? Because this is being talked about as a kind of, it's a military coup, but it's an okay military coup, according to the US. Now, the Muslim Brotherhood are an interesting organisation, but you can't deny that there were hundreds of thousands of people turned out on the street in Cairo calling for change. It's that not exactly the same as a little putsch, where a few military people going in and arresting or killing the elected president, is it?
No, but the real danger in Egypt is that it goes down the Syrian road. That is the fear. And I think everybody ought to take a deep breath and step back from that. The Muslim Brotherhood exist, and they can't be made to go away, even if you wanted to. I think one of the things that's really interesting about this is that Qatar has lost out. The military in Egypt, I believe, moved against Morsi because he was talking about the Egyptian army going into Syria to support a Western intervention in Syria, and the Egyptian army said, no way, Jose, we're going to remove you rather than do that. And in actual fact, Qatar supported the Muslim Brotherhood, and they've been excluded from the new regime. And Saudi Arabia supports the new regime along with the Americans because the Saudis are rather frightened of the Muslim Brotherhood. They've got the same religion, they're Sunnis, although the Saudis are Wahhabis, which is a more extreme version of Sunnism. But nevertheless, the Saudis see the Muslim Brotherhood as a threat to their regime, so they're quite happy to see Morsi removed. So you would be wrong to imagine that King Fahd and those people are unhappy to see him go.
But about the Muslim Brotherhood, surely, you know, Saab Qutb, if you look at the brilliant documentary by Adam Curtis, The Power of Nightmares, that actually the Muslim Brotherhood was started by MI6, by the Western Intelligence Services.
The Muslim Brotherhood, people think of the Muslim Brotherhood as this kind of indigenous kind of rebellious movement, and in some respects it is, but it's been very heavily infiltrated by Western intelligence services for generations. And it was always, for example, the Muslim Brotherhood were banned under Nasser because he saw them as cat's paws for the British. And the Muslims, and also Hamas originally was set up, for example, by Israeli intelligence people because they wanted fundamentalist Muslims to undermine nationalist opposition to their program. It's getting very messy and complicated now. Different sides are being taken. all, you know, there's a real potential for this to just blow up as a major war spreading from, you know, Kurdistan in the east to the Maghreb, you know, which could be.
So what about the Muslim Brotherhood? Concerned. Have they gone native? Are they still controlled by Western intelligence?
I think the fact is that they're like Hamas, they've got an independent existence now. Whatever the West thought that they could use them to do, I think if I was an Egyptian. I'm not, and it's very hard to say. If you were an Egyptian, you'd probably have your own very strong views about this. But I really hope that they do not go down the road of having an armed confrontation about all of this, because we can see where that ends. We're looking in Syria.
Well, what about elections in Egypt?
Well, that's what the Western powers are suggesting they should do. I think the army may or may not call an election. We'll have to see. But the Muslim Brotherhood may not accept the legitimacy of an election at this point. Morsi has now been put under house arrest, I understand, and they're saying that the minimum we will accept is that Morsi is reinstated and then we'll negotiate. And of course the army's saying no to that, just as the West is saying the minimum we will do with Assad, he's got to go and then we'll negotiate, and he's saying I'm not going to go. So you've got people digging their heels in all round.
But one of your favourite little institutions, the Brookings Institution, is saying that Egypt should have waited for elections, that they shouldn't have got rid of Morsi, they should have just waited until the natural time, the end of his period of presidency.
Well, that's what the Muslim Brotherhood would argue. And of course Erdogan in Turkey is saying exactly the same thing about the people protesting against him. Look, there's an election coming up. If you want me out, go to the election. I think it's very, democracy is not just about free elections, it's about people feeling that they have a say, and also that they want to be able to protest against things they don't like. But on the other hand, there are so many. One of the other factors in Morsi's removal, from the point of view of the protesters, was that he just signed up to the IMF's structural adjustment program for Egypt, which basically means the poor are going to have to cop it. So what tends to happen is whoever comes to power after a democratic election, after decades of dictatorship, they say, "Phew, we've managed to get a democratic election. Here we are." And then the IMF says, "Yes, but you owe us loads of money." I say, "Well, we don't owe you loads of money. It was the previous people who borrowed the money." Yes, but you owe it us, because that is one of the problems, is that all states carry over the debts of the previous administration. So you could argue that
the
money that Egypt borrowed wasn't spent on ordinary people, it was spent on the regime.
What is the point of having an election if whoever gets in power is actually having their arms twisted behind their back by the loan sharks?
Well, that's a very good question, which is why communist Cuba just said, you know, we're not having anything to do with elections or the IMF. But I mean, that's a very special niche solution.
BCFM 93.2. Bristol is our community.
Moving back to Syria, we were chatting about that with Charlotte before the news. Israeli submarine was responsible for the July attack on the Syrian arms depot. The Times has cited Middle East intelligence sources as saying that the British Sunday Times, that the Israeli Dolphin-class submarines targeted a contingent of 50 Russian-made Yakont P-800 anti-ship missiles that had reportedly arrived earlier this year to support Syrian President Bashar al-Assad's regime. The alleged Israeli naval strike was reportedly closely coordinated with the United States. The Yakont is an expert version of the Russian P-800 Onyx supersonic cruise missile, which can carry 200 kilogram warheads as far as 300 kilometers. They can be launched from land, sea, air or submarine. The Yakont missiles are also capable of cruising several meters above the water surface, making them very difficult to detect by radar. Now, just so we're not getting confused here, it's an Israeli missile. It looks fired from an Israeli submarine that's destroyed a whole bunch of these very high-tech anti-ship missiles, which were being shipped from Russia to the Syrian government. Now, I suppose the main question here is this an act of war? Is this how does this fit in to the UN Charter?
Well, I mean, the Syrians have denounced it as unacceptable, as have the Russians, as they would. The question is, are they prepared to strike back at the Israelis? And the Russians will be thinking, are we prepared to fight with Israel? And the Israelis will be thinking, are we ready to fight with Russia?
It was not the FSA that targeted this, what Reuters were told. It's not an attack that was carried out by rebels. This attack was either by an air raid or long-range missiles fired from boats in the Mediterranean. Israel has neither confirmed nor denied involvement in the attack. The Israeli submarine fleet consists of 5 Dolphin-class boats. The vessels are developed and constructed for the IDF between 1998 and 2012
by the Germans
Hochwaldwerke Deutsche Werke. shipping company. The Dolphin class boats are considered among the most sophisticated and capable conventionally powered subs in the world. Each submarine carries up to 16 torpedoes, cruise missiles, which have a range of 1,500 kilometres and are equipped with conventional warheads or a 200 kilometre nuclear warhead.
Right, the important military point for people to get from this is that the US has been predominant in aircraft carriers for the last 20 or 30 years. I think they've got something like 37 aircraft carriers. Britain's got one, but no aircraft, and France has got two, the Russians have got two, one in the Mediterranean, one in the Caribbean. Now, the Russian and Chinese general staffs have had a problem because they could try and build aircraft carriers to compete with the Americans, but hey, that's going to cost a fortune, and you're never going to keep up. If you manage to get to a level where you had 37 aircraft carriers, the Americans would make sure they had 67. So it's not really a sensible option. So what they've decided to do, very sensibly, is develop missiles that kill aircraft carriers. And that's what these missiles are that the Israelis have hit. Now, I don't know how many they've taken down, but a missile that kills aircraft carriers is a lot cheaper than an aircraft carrier. So the US has got 37 aircraft carriers, and the US and the Chinese and the Russians between them have something like 30,000 of these missiles, I'm not quite sure, but more than enough. They're 98% effective at killing aircraft carriers, and this is why Putin hangs tough when he's talking to the West. If it comes to a fight in the Eastern Mediterranean, we're confident that we can win, because you're fighting World War II with aircraft carriers, and we're fighting World War III with our new missiles, and that, in fact, is what might keep the peace.
BCFM 93.2. Bristol is our community.
Still with the Middle East, Hezbollah are rattled as the EU unanimously agrees to put group on terrorism blacklist. Well, Brussels has broken ties with the military wing of the Lebanese organisation, but what will it mean on the ground? The 28 members of the European Union on Monday unanimously agreed to label Hezbollah's militant wing a terrorist organisation, making it illegal to send money and enabling its assets in Europe to be frozen.
Yeah, this is all part of the psycho war around Syria, because Hezbollah, of course, have been allied with Assad's forces inside the Syrian border.
Now, I can remember a couple of years ago, we had someone from Hezbollah, from one of the newspapers of Hezbollah, speaking in the council house here in Bristol.
Yes, and various people tried to stop him speaking, including some of the Conservative members of the council, but of course they were not able to succeed. Now, this is all based around a so-called a bomb attack in Bulgaria, which was supposedly carried out by Hezbollah on Israeli tourists. Now, the Bulgarians have actually been very careful not to say that it was Hezbollah who carried it out. In actual fact, there is no real evidence that they carried out the attack. And there is quite a lot of evidence that it may have been the Israelis themselves who carried out the attack. So, for example, in Argentina, a former government minister of Jewish extraction is now on trial for carrying out a bomb attack on these Jewish community centre in Buenos Aires, which killed 85 people, blamed on Iran. But the Argentine police now say, no, it wasn't Iran, it was our minister collaborating with the Israelis. So the Israelis have got a track record of attacking their own people in order to create the idea that they are under attack. Now, the Bulgarians have not in fact pointed the finger at Hezbollah. They said, we don't know who did it. But in actual fact, if it was the Israelis who carried out the attack on their own people in Bulgaria, then making Hezbollah the scapegoats for that. What we're talking about here is all the run-ups, like Gliwice, when Poland was invaded by Hitler. He pretended that the Poles had attacked the customs point at Gliwice. These kind of manoeuvres are the prelude to all-out war, I'm afraid.
Well, let's hope not. Also, this week marks 2 years since the attacks by the far-right Freemason extremist Anders Behring Breivik over in Norway. And I wonder what your thoughts are on that, Martin. One article in the Norwegian press is saying racism in Norway thrives after 22/7. I was quite shocked to see that a Norwegian blogger, Fjordman, who was a big supporter of Breivik, and who Breivik said was one of the people who inspired him to carry out the attacks, has just won a £10,000 prize for freedom of speech and been given the money to help him promote his far-right book over in Norway.
Yes, well, I mean, our friend Torstein Vidal has been investigating all of this based in Oslo. My suspicion about this, and we can't prove it yet, but we're looking into it, is that the attack in Norway by Breivik was part of the Gladio style attacks that we've seen across Western Europe since about 1969. If anybody wants to know what Gladio is, just do a search engine and you will, on your computer, you will find all the evidence about it. There's actually a book that's just been written by Fernando Imposimato, who's the head of the Italian Supreme Court, called La Repubblica dei Strani Impuni, in other words, the Republic of the Unpunished Massacres, based upon years of work by the Italian police force, which blames NATO intelligence services for bombing Bologna railway station in 1980 that killed 80-odd people, blames NATO intelligence services for the kidnap of Aldo Moro, the Italian prime minister, and his assassination, blames NATO intelligence services for bombing of Piazza Fontana in 1969, which began the so-called Strategia di Tensione in Italy. Now, and Olaf Palme's assassination who was the Prime Minister of Sweden, has also been linked to this Gladio-style stuff. Now, in other words, the suspicion here is that killing 67 Labour Party young socialists on Utøya is part of NATO's strategy for fomenting the war on terror. And we may be wrong about this, but there is a track record investigated by the Italian police and others. There's been three investigations by the Italian Parliament, by the Swiss Parliament, and by the Belgian Parliament, and they all concluded that NATO intelligence services were behind these terrorist attacks in the 70s, the 80s. And this may well be a continuation of that. And so what we're perhaps seeing here is far-right and Islamist groups both being manipulated by the intelligence services to create a climate of fear,
well,
a strategy of fear.
Sorry to contradict you, but according to Wikipedia, Breivik was a lone wolf.
Well, this is the question. They're all lone wolves, aren't they? Except that he himself said that he had links with the English Defence League and the Knights Templar. Now, all of course...
He actually visited Britain in 2002, yeah, didn't he? And met up as part of an organisation which founded the English Defence League.
Exactly.
Quite incredibly.
The secret services were running these kind of strategy of tension in Italy, they were running both left and right wing terrorist groups. The same in the Ergokonon network, which is a lot of the top generals in Turkey, their NATO generals, have been put in prison by Erdogan for running the Ergonican network, and they were doing exactly the same. They were running the Grey Wolves, who were right-wing nationalist terrorists, they were running Islamist terrorism, and they were running left-wing terrorism indirectly. The left-wing terrorists often thought that they were being heroes, but in actual fact they were being used, and it's all part of standard NATO practice.
Well, almost nothing has been said about Breivik's membership of the Freemasons, has it? And I mean, one would have thought that this was actually rather significant, particularly because of the secret oaths that are sworn by these Freemasons, and the whole way that he would be a member of at least one, probably several lodges, all of which are other secret members within those lodges. Now, that is the perfect, surely. And also, we know that the police are often members of these Masonic lodges. This is a perfect place for liaisons to go on, that where he can appear to be a lone wolf, but actually he's not.
Indeed, and I think these things...
We could connect this back, actually, to the P2 in Italy, too.
Well, P2...
Because that was a Masonic conspiracy.
Yes, well, P2 was Propaganda Duo, which was the Masonic lodge at the heart of the Gladio structure in Italy. I mean, all of this is historical fact. It's not conspiracy.
So it's strange, isn't it? I mean, on the first anniversary and the second, no mention of this Masonic connection. There's also one of the things that has been dug out by some of the researchers over in Norway is that there were at least two incidents where the police appeared to have actually helped Breivik to actually get from Oslo after he'd blown the bomb up to Utøya Island, which was about an hour's drive away. First of all, whoever was in charge of the police, and they won't say who was, refused twice to allow the police helicopter to be launched to follow the car, even though they had the number. And also, there was supposed to be a roadblock put up in between Oslo and Utøya, but for no explicable reason, the two police patrol cars in the place that could have stopped him both refused to set up a roadblock.
Yes, and these kind of anomalies are the sort of thing that ask questions. Is this incompetence, or is it something more? And when we say, is it something more, we do it on the background of understanding that NATO intelligence services have form for carrying out terrorist attacks. That's not conspiracy theory, that is absolute fact. Daniel Ganser, the Swiss academic, has written a book called NATO's Secret Armies. Fernando Imposimato, who is the head of the Italian Supreme Court, has just written a book about all of this. Now, this is the problem. You don't hear this stuff on Radio 4, do you? It's only on Bristol Community Radio with radicals like ourselves pointing out stuff which is well known. If you sit in a bar in Northern Italy and talk about this stuff, people know what we're talking about, but not in Surrey.
Drive Time on BCFM, 5 till 7 on 93.2 FM.
Finally, Martin, Al-Qaeda claims Iraq prison raids which freed hundreds of inmates. Now, it doesn't seem like there's all that much of a rule of law in this country sometimes when you look at the serious organised crime agency, but back over in Iraq, even if people have been locked up now, they can be freed because local armed groups will come and break down the walls of the prison and just let everybody out.
Well, I mean, it's hard to know exactly what this implies. I mean, several hundred so-called Al-Qaeda terrorists have been released, but I think they are basically Sunni insurgents fighting the Shia-led government in Iran, which was a democratically elected government. And, of course, what's now happening is the Sunni insurgency in Syria is linked with the Sunni insurgency in Iraq. Now, you could argue that in Syria, the Sunnis are a majority and they're trying to get rid of Assad, but he's allied with Nouri al-Maliki in Iraq, who is the elected leader, and he's facing people like this. I mean, these are the people who go around bombing Shia mosques because they're Shias. And, of course, who's benefiting from all of this? Well, ultimately, it's the West and the Israelis who want to see the Sunni and the Shias fighting so that, you know, it's the old Roman slogan, divide and rule, isn't it?
It's a bit frustrating because we've got the people responsible for this, Bush and Blair, still walking free.
Well, indeed. I mean, the image in the West has of itself and the ordinary population have of the West is basically good people who are dealing with some very difficult problems, and we mean well. I mean, coming back to Syria, Roland Dumas, who was the former foreign minister of France, has been giving interviews in the French press saying, long before the Arab Spring, long before anything happened in Tunisia, about a year before, I was approached by the British at international meetings saying, we're going to get rid of Assad, do you want to join in our project? And in other words, the suspicion is that MI6 have actually been arming and training people to overthrow Assad before the Arab Spring began. And then, of course, we have David Cameron saying, oh, what can we do on this terrible war? 90,000 have died. But it may well be not Assad who fired the first shot, but our own MI6.
BCFM 93.2. Bristol is our community.
Well, the British royal family clicked along a generation this week with the arrival of little George, but not a lot of talk about his prematurely departed grandmother, Diana. That's on the mainstream media. No rude questions about assassination or family names not really being Windsor at all. So to redress the balance on the week, George Saxe-Coburg-Gotha was born into this kingdom of lions led by donkeys. Let's hear from Grandma Diana. Here, in her own voice, she describes her 1989 decision to confront her husband's mistress, Camilla, at her sister Annabel Parker Bowles' party.
As Diana began to gain control over the bulimia, her strength returned, and so did her courage. She planned a confrontation with the other woman in her husband's life.
The voice inside me said, just go for the hell of it. So I sat myself up something awful. This was my big step.
It was the winter of 1989. Charles and Diana were invited to a birthday party for Camilla's sister. Unexpectedly, Diana agreed to attend. Bodyguard Ken Wharf drove the couple to the party.
It was clear that Prince of Wales was unhappy that he was being accompanied by his wife, and I'm sure that Diana probably had a hidden agenda here.
After dinner, Diana noticed Charles had slipped away. She went downstairs and found Charles and Camilla talking to another guest.
I said to the two men, okay, boys, I'm just going to have a quick word with Camilla, and I'll be up in a minute. And they shot upstairs like chickens with no heads, and I could feel upstairs all hell breaking loose. What is she going to do?
Diana decided this was the moment to make it clear to Camilla that the royal marriage wasn't big enough for both women.
I was terrified of that, and I said, I know what's going on between you and Charles, and I just want you to know that. And she said to me, very interesting, she said to me, you've got everything you've ever wanted. You've got all the men in the world fall in love with you, and you've got two beautiful children. What more would you want? So I said, I want my husband. And I said to Camilla, I'm sorry I'm in the way, and it must be hell for both of you. But I don't know what's going on. Don't trip me. I can do it.
Tension was high as Worf drove the royal couple home that night.
I remember in the car that there was a debate between the two of them. Some of it seemed to be fairly hostile.
And in the car away back, my husband was over me like a bad rash. And I cried like I've never cried before. It was anger. It was 7 years of pent-up anger coming out.
Diana called it one of the bravest moments of her entire 10 years of marriage.
And the next morning I woke up and I felt different. A shift. Tremendous shift. I'd done something said what I felt, but there's still the old jealousy and the anger swirling around, but it wasn't so deathly as it had been before. And that was it, really. It was a big step for me.
There was a different princess in the sense that she'd almost sort of triumphed over something that hitherto had been a huge problem for many, many years. And there was no doubt in my mind that this really signified the ending of a marriage.
Well, certainly did. Old Labour Oxford economist Martin Summers, the constitutional position of the monarchy is a little bit flaky at the moment. We've had all these things with the black spider letters from Prince Charles. Obviously, we wish this new George Windsor or Saxe-Coburg-Gotha, whatever you want to call him, well. But what is the constitutional position of the monarch at the moment? Because we've got, certainly with the heir to the throne and the Queen, they seem to have these vast amounts of wealth and land, and yet they're trying to sort of play a game between halfway between being part of the government and an individual as part of the monarchy, but then they also don't want to be taxed as if they're a corporation, so they're a halfway house. The other thing, of course, is that there is this ability to actually veto some of the laws that are coming through if they affect them. So it doesn't seem like we are actually free of the monarchy in a political sense.
No, and I think it's probably time for this to be looked into so that we actually get it, if we're going to keep the monarchy, that we get it on a basis that we can all support if we're going to have one. I mean, you know, similar, for example, King Harald of Norway, for example, after the Breivik shootings, he was in Oslo Cathedral and he had to lead the service, and with tears in his eyes, he said, and I very much support what he said, whoever our enemies are, what they've got to remember is that freedom is stronger in Norway than ever. And, you know, you can't go around killing 67 young socialists and expect that you're going to get anything other than that kind of response from the Norwegians. Now, I think our monarchy could be like the Norwegian monarchy, something that's sort of, you know, low cost, low to run, low maintenance and well liked. But, of course, there's an awful lot more history. I mean, in Northern Ireland, for example, look at the rows they're having about whether they're going to fly the Union Jack outside City Hall and all the rest of it. There's just such a lot of history in Britain that it's very difficult
to understand. Well, one of the things that's come out recently is every penny you spend in Waitrose, a little bit of it goes into Prince Charles's pocket. Every penny you spend in John Lewis, a few bob of it goes into the Queen's pocket. So they've got these big investments in some of our fundamental industries, something like supermarkets. Everybody needs to use them.
Yeah, well, I would argue if you're going to have a monarchy and it's going to be a kind of a working monarchy, then you pay them to do what they do, and all their other assets should perhaps be taken off them. I mean, the Duchy of Lancaster, as I said on here the other week, why has the Prince Charles got the profits of the Duchy of Lancaster? That belongs, in fact, to the British government. It was given to one of his ancestors many, many hundreds of years ago, but ultimately you could argue that all of that stuff actually belongs to us and not to him.
Yeah, probably about 1,000 years ago, I think.
No, okay. No, it was in the 1300s, I think.
Drive Time on BCFM, 5 till 7 on 93.2 FM.
Well, it starts next week, and it used to be called the Big Green Gathering. Possibly the best of all the family-friendly summer festivals. It used to be called the Big Green Gathering until Avon and Somerset Police and North Somerset Council pulled the licence for it at the last minute with devastating financial consequences back in 2009. One of the organisers of the latest smaller festival, now called the Green Gathering, joins me now here in the studio. Hi, Shane Collins. Welcome to Drive Time.
Evening. Well, thank you.
Now, first of all, I met you, Shane, in a field near the junction of the M3 and the M25 back in 1995, doing a live interview on Newsnight. Just remind us, what were you doing in that field?
Oh my God, was that something to do with Twyford or Newbury anti-roads protest?
It was actually the first diggers meeting organised by George Monbiot, and there I actually remember coming across, what on earth is going on in the corner of the field? It was dark, probably about half past ten, mustn't it, if Newsnight was on, probably 10:45 or something, and there you were, sitting in a bath with a fire underneath the bath, and actually doing some live interview with somebody in the studio, a live link. Back in the days when Newsnight used to do it properly, you remember that?
I remember the bath. I don't remember the interview, but the bath was a beautiful, beautiful bath with a fire under it next to a stream, white camo netting on the top. But yeah, those were heady days. Land is ours, various land occupations, anti-roads, successful anti-roads campaigns. I was very involved at Cool Town Arts in Brixton, which is a sort of four-year self-funded squatted community arts centre. And yeah, those were the days pre-9/11 when we were winning. we were on the up, and slightly different now, but we're still hanging on in there, and the wheel will turn and we are coming back.
Well, actually, the Green Party is doing reasonably well. You've got yourself an MP now. You've also got, I think it's four councillors here in Bristol, in Oxford, doing very well. Generally speaking, what's happening with the Green Party's political representation in cities and town councils other than Westminster?
It's sort of, you know, Brighton, the Green Party now, in the amazing position of actually controlling the council. Lots of sort of small regional towns now are starting to get councillors. So it is changing gradually. Question being whether it's changing quick enough with you know, energy decline and climate change being the yardsticks that we have to keep to.
Now, we were talking about in the first hour the shale gas protest yesterday over in Sussex. Yeah. We've also got a serious problem on our hands just south of here, down in the Mendips. The similar kind of thing apparently going to go on. The BBC, bless them, talking about shale gas is fracking is to do with pumping water into the ground. Sorry, BBC, no, it's not water you're pumping into the ground, it's water and rather nasty toxic chemicals that can then leach into the aquifers and poison us when we're drinking our water. So what are your thoughts about energy policy generally? What, you know, from, I mean, I realize you're a drug spokesperson, but I mean, we have a real dilemma about where we're going with energy. Otherwise, if we don't sort ourselves out, we don't come to some sort of decision here, the lights are just going to go out, aren't they?
I think so, yes. I mean, the renewables have been increased, but not at anything like the rate needed. The feed-in tariff has been cut hugely, which has stopped domestic homeowners or people putting in PVs at home. The Conservative government has basically forgotten about the long-term issues of climate change and is simply doing anything it can to, you know, put a bit of fire.
There was a bit of a rush, wasn't there, of solar panels appearing on people's roofs, and that's now pretty much stopped. But I mean, you know, you yourself surely must admit that nuclear has got to be an option since it's zero carbon.
Well, it's not quite zero carbon by the time you take into account the huge construction costs and then how people make any sort of accounting for nuclear when you think we've got to have a nuclear priesthood for the next 250,000 years. It does seem like sort of supreme intergenerational arrogance when we think how old is our civilization? Well, a couple of thousand years at most. The older civilizations we know is a sort of 7,000 or 8,000 years. We're going to be leaving this legacy for the next 200,000 years. It's disastrous. We're already seeing in the Pacific the fish have got radioactivity in them. The levels of radioactivity in milk on the western parts of the United States and Canada is going up and up, but very, very unreported.
But with these cars,
the main problem with nuclear is, everything else aside, is simply the cost. It's uneconomic. We can't stuff enough subsidy down EDF's throat for even them to agree. You know, all other arguments aside, nuclear is just ridiculously overpriced and expensive. So I think it's slightly moot point. I don't think it's going to go much further because we can't afford it.
But I mean, we've got fantastic reliance now on cars. I mean, we're in a situation in this city where we're overwhelmed by cars parking on all our streets. They're doing the residence parking thing now, and also horrendous problems out there right now as people are going home, sitting in traffic jams, fuming away. This isn't really a very efficient way of doing things. So what about the Green Party's policy to actually make it worthwhile for people to step out of a car and onto a bus, because it's simply not happening? I mean, just today I was driving around, he says, admitting he drives around in his car sometimes, and I see that the first bus, who are virtually a monopoly, have still a very, very large number of the bus routes here in Bristol. This company, a US company, which is massively in debt. And what they've started doing is having different brands of first bus buses to make it look as if there's some sort of competition. So you've got a kind of green and blue logo first bus, and then you've got their other logo. So you're looking around thinking, oh, well, maybe this is a new guy in town, but of course it isn't.
Yeah, I mean, with climate change and peak oil, there's sort of three options. You cannot try try and persuade people to change their ways individually for the common good, which is essentially the sort of game that we've been involved with, lots of Greens have been involved with for the last 20 years. We have to accept the fact that that's failing. People are not making the necessary individual changes for the common good. So the alternative is, you've got a slice of cake, i.e. how much CO2 you can emit, how much fossil fuels have got left. How do we divide it up? Do we simply let whoever can pay for the biggest slice take the cake, or do we ration it? So what we had after the Second World War, we accepted there was a national dilemma, we rationed food. Everybody saw the dilemma, everybody agreed it was fair. What the Greens are suggesting now is we have a personal carbon ration, i.e. an amount that you can emit that won't force climate change and won't put pressure on declining resources. Now, if you don't want to use your ration, you can sell it. And if you want to go and see your kids in Australia or whatever it is, you can buy it. But the key thing is that the overall bubble that's emitted must be one that doesn't force climate change. So how it works, we start from where we are now. Each year for the next 10 years, the bubble, the ration, would drop about 9% a year to bring us down to a 90% cut in CO2 emissions in about 10 years. It's equitable. For Greens, for poorer people who wouldn't use their ration, they would actually get an income. So the big difference for that is that you're asking people to make individual changes for the common good, but they're actually getting paid for it. Because at the moment, it's quite expensive to live a green lifestyle. We were talking land earlier on. You've got to be extremely wealthy to live like a peasant these days. It's very difficult to live green. So with a tradable carbon ration, we think that would A, reward people who live green lifestyles, and B and C, it's the only equitable way to confront peak oil and climate change.
Martin, you've been quite against this on an international scale, haven't you? What do you think of what Shane's saying?
Yeah, I think carbon trading on an international scale is opposed by both the Greenpeace and Friends of the Earth. I think it should be, because what that is an attempt to create another bubble that the hedge fund traders can fiddle around with.
Absolutely,
what you're talking about, from what I'm hearing, is an individual ration rather than countries getting quotas and targets. I think when you mentioned the Second World War there, I was just, ultimately, you could just plan to use less. I mean, we're going to have to plan the economy anyway, in my view, because I'm a socialist, not a free marketeer. And you can plan the reduction of carbon, or the reduction of we should be, whether global warming exists or not, we should use
less
resources.
But I've got news for you, Martin. The energy companies are not planning for us to use less.
No,
they're planning to use for us to use more, and they're in the driving seat.
Take them over and tell them what to do, isn't it?
A simple way the energy companies could change is that you get charged cheaply for the first bit of fuel you use, i.e. the average amount, but if people want to use more than the average, then the cost would go up considerably. That would help people use less fuel. But we've got to accept it, our state, whether it's the government or the corporations, are not run by people who are keen on a non-growth economy. And going back to the Green Party earlier on, that's the desperate problem we have. We are the only field of political thought that are saying, hold on, there are finite limits. We can't continue having a grow economy, because we will run out of resources, the pollution will get us, and it's incredibly inequitable.
I mean, there's echoes here of the limits. Wasn't it the Club of Rome, Limits to Growth report in the 1960s?
Can I just say on this point, when you say a no-growth economy, it doesn't mean an economy that doesn't grow in terms of change and development.
Correct.
Because people tend to think a no-growth economy just means, we're going to go back and live as we did 50 years ago. Now, in actual fact, you would still have measured growth in GDP, you just wouldn't use the same resources.
Yeah.
In other words, the economy would carry on growing and improving, but one of the things you would build in is that over time you use less and less and less resources, which is supposedly what capitalism's good at. It's actually kind of being efficient about the use of resources. And if you put the right, as in Germany, for example, they've got an example, all new build houses have to have zero emissions. That's it. Yeah. And that means everybody's, that's the standard, and everybody's got to meet you. In Britain, we're just having that Help to Buy scheme, which is, if it works, which is questionable, will just lead to a load of gimcrack houses being thrown up with no consideration for environmental.
And people buying them who can't actually afford to pay the mortgage.
Yes, of course, yeah, they will give them the money to buy them as well, yeah.
Now, also, Shane, you are the Green Party's national spokesperson on drugs, I understand. What is the Green Party's position?
Well, ultimately, it's to try and get a sort of criminal market out of the drugs market. It's not so much the drugs that two people harm, while some definitely do if you take too many of them, but it's generally the sort of scraps over selling rights and dealer scraps and that sort of thing. That's where most of the sort of violence we hear about, the gun crime and knife crime these days, a lot of it originates in, you know, gangs, bunches of people, and the top people in those gangs tend to deal drugs. And since they can't, if there's any disputes, they can't go to the small claims court, it tends to be, you know, threats of baseball bats or actual baseball bats. So ultimately, you know, irrespective of the danger, because we do accept that there are some dangers associated with some drugs, we just want to get the crime market out of it, let people make informed decisions themselves. And at the moment, it's used, the drug laws are used on one hand just to sort of bolster the Daily Mail ratings for whatever party needs bolstering at the time, but it's not based on evidence. It's completely evidence free.
I mean, how do you do that without allowing people to go pop into their local Tesco's and buy heroin?
Very good question, one we wrestled with in the Green Party when we came up with our policy in particular towards cannabis. We don't want to see big business supermarkets dealing cannabis. We quite like the fact that lots and lots of little people at the moment are involved in the production and the sale of cannabis. We don't want to knock them out of a job completely. So how we'd like to get round it is, say, no advertising of cannabis, rather like they do in Holland. Even coffee shops can't even have a cannabis leaf on the window. So it's low key, but it keeps it little person's business. And if there's no advertising, then we don't think that the big supermarket chains, this sort of thing, will want to get involved.
So no heroin at Tesco's, but you can buy it at the corner shop?
No, we would still have heroin in particular being illegal for anybody to sell, rather like alcohol is illegal for anybody to sell, but we would say that it would be legal to get a prescription of heroin from your doctor.
But alcohol's not illegal to sell?
It is, yeah, you need a license to sell it.
Okay, so it would license, be, you would illegal. Be licensing that, and I mean, whereabouts, correct, yeah. Whereabouts so would those licenses, who would be given them?
Well, for heroin, it would be doctors, GPs, whatever the system would be set up. But at the moment, we still have a huge, huge heroin addictive population in Britain. It's maybe 80,000-100,000 people. And that's the motor for much of crime. You know, the choice is fairly simple. You give people a prescription dose of heroin, bring them into the system, and the crime rate drops. Or you leave them running wild, and, you know, the crime rate carries on going up.
Martin, what about the links between the sort of money that's being made by organised crime right now from these various drugs that Shane's talking about and things like terrorism, things around the world? Whereabouts does this money actually end up?
Well, I think the fact is, as I've said many, there's a UN report on crime and drugs that came out in 2009. I have a copy on my computer, and it was written by, you know, police officers associated with the UN. And they just pointed out that during the 2008 banking crisis, all the dirty money in the world, all of it, was simply sucked into the banking system in one go.
Isn't
just
that?
Like that. And so, in other words, the banking system that we all...
So are you talking about cash held by these drug cartels?
Yes, because they said, you've got a problem, you need money, we've got some.
So
Gordon Brown said he was saving the world, didn't he, by bailing out the banks, but actually what was really happening is all of the dirty money in the world was being sucked into
the private financial system is entirely dependent upon two pillars. One is the taxpayer, two is the drug cartels. All the major political forces in Latin America are now talking about legalization. It's really on the agenda. I mean, the Pope spoke in Brazil yesterday as opposed to it, but that's because it's definitely on the agenda. And it's not just a question of, wouldn't it be nice if people were allowed to smoke cannabis without being persecuted? Of course it would. The real problem is the dirty money at the heart of all of this.
Yeah.
And the other thing, of course, which people fail to recognize is that Western intelligence service, we talked about them being involved in terrorism earlier, they've also been involved in drug dealing. The Iran-Contra affair, the heart of the Iran-Contra affair, was that Adolfo Calero, who was the head of the FLN, the Contras in Nicaragua, was flying planes full of cocaine into Mena Air Base in Arkansas when Bill Clinton was the governor, and they were flying back with small arms for the Contras, all of which was done under the aegis of Oliver North, who is still a TV personality on US TV and rather popular on the right wing of politics there. But he is the biggest drug dealer on the planet. I mean, what happened in Colombia, because I'm involved in the Colombia Solidarity Campaign, is that the Medellin cartel were not cooperating with the Outer Unidas Defenses to Colombia, the right wing paramilitaries, so they were targeted by the DEA and the military and the police. But the Cali cartel, who were working with AUC, they were allowed to operate. So the way that the Western intelligence services, or the CIA mainly, run this is they've got all the law enforcement to deal with the competition. And the fact, if you're on our side, you've got to. There was a plane crashed in northern Mexico a couple of years ago now. It was full of cocaine, standard stuff. The police found it. Guess where that plane had previously been seen? It was by people on the Glasgow airport, being used by the CIA for illegal rendition flights. The same plane. And then it turns up in Mexico full of cocaine. People need to work. You know, this is the reality. Yeah. And this is why the Latin American presidents are going to have a hard time pushing this through, because the CIA and people like that have been they funded the Hmong were encouraged to produce heroin in the Golden Triangle to fund anti-communist guerrillas. The nationalist Chinese were the first to do this on a big scale. There's a really good website about this, CIADrugs.com or Narco News. Again, all of it, not conspiracy theory, just historical fact. So, Western intelligence services, terrorists and drug dealers.
Well, you keep talking about the CIA, but what about the City of London? What about the British intelligence services?
Well,
These are pretty much unaccountable organisations nowadays. I mean, you've got Sir Malcolm Rifkin, in charge of all that, who he is actually in the pay of the defence companies.
The Bank of Credit and Commerce International, if people remember that crashing, that was again a front company for all of this. Now, part of the problem is that rational arguments about what we should do about drugs are caught up then in the geopolitical strategies of the Western intelligence services.
Yeah.
But the fact is, ultimately, they are vulnerable. Once we get people to realise what's going on, then we ought to be able to take these people down, and we should.
Shane, do you think that the Green Party is actually having much traction with the policy? Because obviously for many people, they don't like the idea of legalising these. It's almost like giving up with trying to control drugs.
Yeah, conversely to that, people who've seen through the sort of official line on drugs are absolutely delighted that there's a political party who've also seen through it, and you know, our members have got together and we, the members, decided to change the policy.
I mean, we had a Lib Dem in here recently who was saying similar things about... I mean, do you find that some of your views are echoed amongst other political parties?
Oh, God, yeah. I mean, I used to be on the Lambeth Community Police Consultative Group, and over the course of about 10 years, I've had three different police commanders, borough commanders, say to me on the quiet... off the record, I completely agree with what you're saying, but they can't say it officially. No, it's common sense expanded. Anybody after a short period of reading can see the sense of it. A lot of people will say, oh, there'll be an explosion of drug taking. Well, that's not what happened in Holland. When Holland liberalised their drug laws and legalised cannabis, there was initially a rise in people who was too scared before because it was criminal offence, but that actually went down. And I think the important thing for lots of people who it was for the sort of forbidden fruit because they were told not to, they had a go. When it's legal, you know, cannabis in Holland's considered fairly boring by the youth. They're much more interested in alcohol. It's taken the forbidden fruit away, so there's no reason to suspect that there would be a huge explosion in people smoking weed or whatever it is.
Okay, moving on to the Green Gathering now, because that's starting next week. You're one of the organisers of that. What is the Green Gathering?
What is the Green Gathering? Well, it sort of came out of the green fields of Glastonbury and the old Ecology Party, the old Green Party, and it was basically trying to find a place for Greens to network in our own sort of environment. So it is a wonderful, wonderful festival. If you haven't been, it's quite hard to imagine a few thousand people in a field with no fossil fuels being used for powering it, other than a bit of gas for cooking. The atmosphere changes hugely. There's no loud central stage. There's lots of smaller stages. It's highly intense and active within, you know, within the music. But overall, there's a beautiful view of the Severn Bridge, the Severn Estuary. It's 100 metres into Wales by Chepstow Racecourse. For people to hang out, relax, network, for kids, it's a dream. My four-year-old daughter, it's been the big thrill of the last 2 years of her life. She's going to see Rinky Dink, so she's happy.
Okay, what are the sort of separate areas? What sort of areas do you have? Because I know that it's not just a sort of Green Party thing. You're also bringing in all sorts of things. One of the things I remember seeing one of the past years, for example, was Green Futures, the sustainable housing type thing.
Yeah.
So what else have you got there?
We've got the Healing Zone, we've got Good Campaign Zone, Teens Area, a Kids Area, Permaculture, Crafts, lots and lots.
Permaculture is one of those words I hear from time to time. I don't necessarily understand actually what it is. What's that all about?
Essentially,
it sounds green, doesn't it? But what is it?
It's about trying to get maximum input for output from an area of land with minimum input. So you try and plant plants that will produce lots of fruits but don't require lots of intensive work from you. So you'd plant a ground level and then bushes and then trees, and they would all be productive in some way. So in theory, it's low input, high output. And it's also, you know, it produces good fresh food. We've got Charles Dowding, who's one of the sort of masters of no-dig salad farming. We've got a huge permaculture area with lots of practitioners. Mike Feingold from Bristol, permaculture groups coming along. There's a whole load of things. We talks on GMOs in the UK, where they're up at the where they're to at the moment. Someone's just come back from the World Social Forum in Tunisia. Janie Mack's going to talk about what's going on there.
Well, it's very kind because you invited me to come and give a talk on over there on Saturday, Saturday week.
Journalist is widely unknown in many places. Tony Gosling doing a talk on journalism as a revolutionary act on Saturday at 3.
Is that what I called my talk? Goodness me. And what about eco-villages? That's another big passion of mine. I think you've got something on them too.
Yes, we've got Paul Wimbush from Lammas, which is an eco-village in Wales, and it's basically going through how to set one up either as a small holding your own or as they've done at Lammas with other people. It is possible. You need wheelbarrows full of paperwork, but you know, people do it in the end. It has to be said, the situation in Britain is of land ownership, where you know a third of the country is still owned by the bloody Normans.
Apologies for Shane swearing.
Oh yeah, they cut themselves.
You shouldn't be swearing, Shane. That's a bit naughty. So apologies to listeners.
But you know, it's still desperately, desperately hard to buy a piece of land to live on in a low impact way. But Lammas have done it. They're going to tell us doing it how to do it. We've got other people there who grow mushrooms as a small holding who are going to come and talk about
that. So it sounds to me like a lot about self-sufficiency. Very, very useful when the money supply is drying up. Whereabouts? You said it's near Chepstow Racecourse. When exactly is it on? And how much is it if people want to go?
It's from the 1st of August to the 4th of August, i.e. Thursday to Sunday next week. There's day tickets for £25. Or tickets on the gate will be £130. They're £115 this week, or you can get various offers via the Spark or local transition groups or Rising Tide. Basically, we're trying to sell the tickets through environmental groups. We sell them at a reduced price, and then a few quid comes back to the environmental.
Fantastic.
Groups.
Well, the website, if people are interested, is Green Gathering 2013. It's www.greengathering.org.uk, as Shane there said, running from the 1st to the 4th of August at a site near Chepstow in the landscape grounds of Piercefield Park. So Shane Collins from the Green Party talking about just about everything there, drugs and all sorts. Thanks very much for joining us on Drive Time.
Thank you. Fascinating.
Drive Time on BCFM, 5 till 7 on 93.2 FM.
One of my favourite spots on this show is covering foreign broadcasts such as Iran's English language channel Press TV, which is now censored here in the UK, banned. So, we don't often cover the lives of modern so-called celebrity gods and goddesses on this show, but this week saw a new distribution of a fascinating documentary about these superstars. It comes from North Korea and it features Madonna, Brad Pitt, Angelina Jolie, Katie Price and Paris Hilton. So, let's see what Pyongyang makes of our so-called finest talent.
In surveys, 9 out of 10 women in the West are unhappy with their appearance, which drives them to spend enormous amounts of money buying cosmetics, clothes, and plastic surgery, despite the fact that they will never become celebrities or look like the models in the advertisements. This is consumerism. Many of the biggest celebrities have no talent at all. This very famous woman is called Miss Katie Price. Her brand name is Jordan. And despite my research, it seems clear that she doesn't actually do anything. This is Miss Paris Hilton. This narcissistic parasite comes from a wealthy hotel family. She glorifies her opulent lifestyle without guilt and is said to charge $150,000 to appear at parties. She even has a TV program called My New Best Friend Forever, where people compete to be her new best friend. Proof that anything in the West can be reproduced and commodified for profit. This is part of a trend in the West for what is called reality television. A type of freak show programming about talentless narcissists who like to talk about themselves and go shopping. They know the names of each one of these actors, and yet they don't know where Britain is on the map, despite the efforts of the British to be their best friends. This is ideal, of course. Keep the masses ignorant and pacified on the couch. Distract them with violence, death, and the illusions of celebrity. Reduce resistance in thought. Make them choose the bland over the brilliant. The meaningless over the thoughtful. And dazzle them with trash.
That was the North Korean take on our celebrity culture. Time to sign off now, because next up maybe Cyrus the Virus. Never quite sure. Doesn't seem to have appeared this week. But anyway, thanks very much to our guests in the first hour, Conservative MP for Bristol North West, Charlotte Leslie. Thanks also to Shane Collins from the Green Party and, of course, old Labour Oxford economist Martin Summers. Next week, Shale Gas and Mark Weston, Martin Summers' great adversary, is back. I'm Tony Gosling. Thanks very much for listening.
Sky News Centre at 7. Stuart Hall's prison sentence has been doubled. The Court of Appeal ruled the broadcaster's original 15-month jail term for...